Thanks for listening to Air Talk while Larry is away. I'm Libby Denkman, senior politics reporter for KBCC. Keeping the seat warm here all week. Different reporters and personalities here at KPCC will be filling in for Larry. So thank you for listening. Well, California's death count from the coronavirus has surpassed 15,000, even as we saw widespread improvement in the number of people infected with COVID-19 in the state. New numbers from Johns Hopkins University put California's death toll at 15,026, behind New York, New Jersey, and Texas. California has had the most confirmed virus cases in the country, but key indicators like hospitalizations have fallen dramatically since that spike that we saw after Memorial Day weekend that prompted statewide shutdowns. Nationally, the U.S. is approaching 200,000 deaths from the coronavirus, and that is the most in the world. Every day during this pandemic, we have been getting your coronavirus questions answered, fact-checked information that you can use in your everyday life from medical experts. And joining me today, as he has in past weeks, is Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at the UCSF Medical Center. Dr. Chin Hong, hello again.
Hey, Libby. Thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. You know, first, we have changing advice out of the CDC that really has my head spinning. Lately, the CDC has been kind of going back and forth on guidelines about whether coronavirus can spread through respiratory droplets or small particles, such as those in aerosols. They had added that guidance back in on Friday, and then just today, we're seeing that they've removed the guidance again. Are you concerned about the confusion this is causing or could cause in the public?
Certainly. I think this is just one part of a long litany of mixed messaging, of back and forth between HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, sort of like the right hand of the government, and the CDC, until now seen as really the preeminent group of scientists engaged in public health. So I think this back and forth is really damaging, I think, in terms of what the community receives in terms of what we should do.
What should people know about the spread of COVID-19 through aerosols or through small particles?
Well, I think it's really about risk reduction, and nothing in life is really 100% foolproof, meaning that if I give you a cholesterol medicine to prevent a heart attack, I'm not giving that to you saying you're never going to get a heart attack, but you're going to have your risk substantially reduced. So I think about that framework when I think about aerosol transmission or airborne transmission with COVID. It can happen, but there are certain situations where the probability is much higher. And when we think about wearing masks and practicing social distancing and washing our hands, we really reduce that risk substantially. And I guess at the bottom line, what it shows me or tells me is that an indoor cramped area with very little ventilation is really a super high risk area. But for most places, when you institute those personal protection measures, you're going to be fine.
Mm. If you want to ask Dr. Chin Hong a question, you can call us at 866-893-5722. You can also post a question on our Facebook page. You can tweet at me. I'm at L-I-B-D-E-N-K, LibDenk. Again, the number is 866-893-5722. You can reach us on Twitter at AirTalk as well. Dr. Chin Hong, we are approaching that 200,000 death milestone that I mentioned previously. What do you make of the staggering loss in the United States so far in the months since the pandemic began?
Well, I'm usually a half glass full kind of person, but I'm really dismayed by those numbers. I think when we heard those predictions early in the summer that we'd reach the 200,000 mark, and I guess pundits from the University of Washington were some of the first to really sound that grim milestone as a possibility. I think a lot of people are disbelieving, but again, you know, many of us on the ground thought it was inevitable because, again, we have no national strategy. every state is doing its own thing, but at the same time, every state has porous borders, and we're just at the behest of the surrounding states next to us. So it's really foolhardy to not have a national strategy, have states do their own things, but we're acting like 50 different countries.
And when you say that there's no national strategy, that states are doing their own things, what are the specific things that a national strategy would have taken care of or done differently than what we've seen in the last several months?
I think from the beginning, one of the biggest stumbling blocks for us as the United States was really not having a national distribution of testing. So basically, we were operating like we had, you know, ointment all over our eyes, so we couldn't see what was really around amongst us at the time, and that was quite early in the year, in January even, or late December, which were COVID cases circulating. We didn't have the technology to really detect those infections, and that was really, you know, the straw break the camel's back, because without testing, we couldn't see what was going on. If we had a national strategy to ensure that everyone was getting testing, that would have really been a really important feature to really target and stop the virus in its tracks. And that led to more and more. It was like a domino effect. Testing, lack of testing, national strategy led to lack of distribution of PPE. People were anxious. We couldn't protect ourselves. And we had to go, you know, begging the community members from the hospital to give us masks because we didn't have enough. Led to lack of national distribution of testing supplies. So, one failure led to another and another and another. And, you know, I think of it like a heart beating, and not in synchrony, but, we call it ventricular fibrillation. And in the hospital, it's like the heart is trying to beat, but the muscles aren't coordinated. And as a result, you get organ damage. And that's what we have. We have like, all the states are like the organs in the body. We don't have the heart beating, and we're just dying.
Mm. A lot of people point to South Korea as a good benchmark for cases that showed up around the same time as those in the U.S., but case counts and fatalities that presented in a very different rate, and the curve there, much lower and much flatter than in the United States. What are the differences that countries that got things under control faster did? What strategies, in addition to, again, you know, what you said, testing, was it masks? Was it awareness? What happened in these countries, and why was the U.S. not following suit?
So there's several things, I think, that led to a difference between some countries' epidemics and ours. The first was the most important thing was like the national voice, like we had mentioned. But the second thing was really the alignment between science and politics. And of course, some people say when you mix science and politics, you get politics. But nevertheless, when you look at countries like Taiwan, like Germany, they had this really strong central scientific voice right next to the politician. And it was a dialogue, not a hierarchy. So I think that was a super important thing. And then finally, I think there were cultural issues as well. Mask wearing is much more common in many parts of the world, particularly in Asia. I think we adopted that much later than we should have, even though we knew how this virus was spread generally from the beginning. If you ask any infectious disease doctor, they would tell you it's a respiratory virus. We've had other coronaviruses before, so I think the combination of not knowing how much was in our community by lack of testing, the lack of cultural acceptance of masks early on, and lack of guidance to wear such masks really led to the perfect storm.
Stacy writes in from West LA, and she says, with all the smoke particles in the air, does that affect COVID-19 spread? Does it increase people's risk of contracting a respiratory illness?
Yes. So, in general, before we get to COVID, wildfires and act like a severe dose of pollution. So we think about a micron particle or a particle of 2.5 micrometers as being like small enough where you can get to the deepest recesses of the lung and cause damage and inflammation and clog it up, essentially. Wildfires are full of these very, very small particles. So it can cause people to have lung disease, emphysema, and then with chronic exposure, heart disease and strokes. But in terms of COVID-19, there are two aspects that I would highlight with wildfires and COVID. First of all, if you have COVID and you're asymptomatic, you're not coughing, maybe you're not spreading as much, having these pollutants or wildfire smoke can make you all of a sudden start coughing. And then, you know, we know already from data that that can spread the virus much more efficiently. So it gives the virus, which lands, which travels on a droplet, usually superpowers because you're projecting it further. Secondly, if you were negative, COVID negative, and you got exposed to wildfire smoke, what that does is inflame that lining of the nose and the mouth, the very vulnerable lining where COVID is trying to get to. It's like the five-star hotel for COVID. So it's trying to land there, and all of a sudden the doors are all open. It's like you're open for business because you have all that inflammation. If you're destroying or inflaming that lining, that
we don't want to be hospitable like that to the virus, right, doctor?
Totally don't want. I want to close that shop immediately, but that's what the wildfire does. So it makes you both transmit the virus more efficiently, we think, as well as become more susceptible to the virus landing on you.
Mm. That's Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Final question for you, doctor. As we head into the fall and the winter, the weather is getting colder. What are your concerns about the season changing and what that could mean for this pandemic?
So we know that COVID loves people most of all. It loves noses and mouths getting together closely. But apart from that, it loves cold more than heat. So that's one secondary factor. But the most important thing is people are, particularly in our temperate areas of the state, are going to be indoors more than out as it gets colder. And again, indoors is like a festering ground for COVID because it can probably linger in the air if you have poor ventilation a little bit longer in these aerosols. So I'm worried about COVID in the winter. And again, we think about the twindemic of influenza and COVID as interacting with each other, presenting with very, very similar symptoms and potentially putting a strain on testing resources as well as hospitalizations and hospitalization capacity.
So if folks are, you know, thinking about having any kind of social gatherings, even small ones, for the holidays, for example, what is your advice? I mean, bundle up, do it outside or not at all?
I'd say try to be modest. Don't have like a class reunion indoors. Try to have it in a time of day when it's less cold. So maybe a brunch instead of a dinner. Have it outdoors instead of indoors. But if you have it indoors, crack open the window. Buy a portable HEPA filter if you're staying in an old house or you're not sure about the ventilation. So these are all things that people can do. Keep your pods 6 feet apart or more. And the pods can just stay where they are. And for example, if you invite two small families, the families can obviously interact with each other. So you don't have to do complex, calculus and go on a computer and figure out a configuration where every single person is 6 feet apart. So those are some things that people have done. They've also have models where the host goes around and gives the food with a mask on instead of people helping themselves willy-nilly, and definitely don't get together and sing "He's a Jolly Good Fellow."
We will listen to that advice, certainly. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at the UCSF Medical Center. Thank you, doctor, very much. And I wish you and all of our listeners good health.
Thanks so much, Libby. Always a joy.
Likewise. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. Coming up, I want to hear from moms. If you have changed your work hours to pick up the childcare duties in your house, or dads, any parents who have had that decision to make to pick up more hours in order to pick up the slack for the closure of daycares and schools, give us a call at 866-893-5722. Parents who have changed the number of hours you are devoting to work in order to take care of your kids, 866-893-5722, or go online, talk to us on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up in just a minute, we're going to talk to our own Mariana Dale about her reporting on how The pandemic is impacting working moms in SoCal. Back in just a minute.